It's our ninth year in New York, and it's always a great time. If you've never been here before, buckle up, because it's a great experience. A couple of rules. If you can avoid it, please try not to eat and drink in the atrium. St. John's is, they're real strict about that. You know, if you can. The bathrooms, the women's room is over here to my right, and the men's room is back. This gentleman is coming out of the bathroom right now. He's waving his hand. There's coffee. There's cake over there. Tonight, normally we go till about 10 o'clock, depending on whatever these guys want to do on Friday. Tomorrow morning, we'll come back at around 8 o'clock, and Bill's going to do a morning meditation from 8 to 8:30 in the atrium, if anybody's interested. But breakfast will be in here from about 8 to 9. So there'll be a note on the atrium door where we normally come in, but it'll kind of be closed for the morning meditation, and then you'll have to come into these doors over here to my right, if anybody's interested. We'll go a few hours. We'll have lunch. Lunch will be around 12 o'clock, maybe 12 to 2. We'll come back after lunch. Pete and Chris will do their thing a little bit more. We'll break around 4 o'clock for a smoke break. And then we have a guy named Mitch Kay here. And he's got a whole bunch of history on Alcoholics Anonymous, if you haven't seen it in the back. I mean, if you haven't seen that in the back, you probably need glasses. But there's a lot of good stuff. And he's going to come up here and do a little bit of a talk on his deal. And we'll break for dinner around 6 o'clock. And then I guess around 8 o'clock, I think Mark Houston is going to speak. And another gentleman from Florida is going to speak tomorrow night. And I'm just kind of giving you a really quick, I don't know if it's going to happen this way, but it might. It never does. And then tomorrow, and then on Sunday, we'll come here around 8 o'clock again. And the conference usually ends around noon on Sunday. So that's kind of a real quick overview of what goes on at these conferences. I'd like to thank all of you for coming. I'd like to thank everybody that does service here with the Fellowship of the Spirit New York and sets up. 2 weeks, a lot goes into it, and it's a great experience just to try to set the place up. Like I said, we have Peter M. from New Jersey tonight. We have Chris S. from New Jersey. And we have Mark K. I don't know where Mitchell's from. Mitchell's from New York. So, upstate New York. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Chris and Pete to my right.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. It's really, really an honor to be asked to do a Fellowship of the Spirit. What is this, the ninth annual one or whatever? It's always been known for some really special stuff. And I want to thank the people that asked me to be involved, definitely. Somewhere in between Christmas and New Year's of 1989, the grace of God separated me from alcohol, and I started to detox, and for about 3 days, I was really unable to get out of the house. But as soon as I was able to get out of the house, I headed off to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I really didn't believe much in Alcoholics Anonymous at this time. The reason being is I'd been in it for a while. I had done almost 90 days in AA. I'd gone through a rehab. And I really, really had a desire to not drink. I really wanted to stay separated from alcohol because I truly knew the sane part of my mind. I truly knew that putting alcohol in my body is a really bad decision. I think a lot of us have been there, knowing that putting alcohol or drugs into our body is a bad decision because of the things that happen, the consequences. But that wasn't sufficient for me to be able to stay separated from drugs and alcohol. Just wasn't working for me. I made what I thought at the time was a real serious attempt to engage in Alcoholics Anonymous and really try this recovery thing. Listen, I didn't want to go to meetings. I mean, you know, that was not on the top 10 list of things Chris wanted to do, join Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me tell you, you know, not a happening guy like me, you know, admitting that kind of defeat. I didn't really know anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous back then. Every once in a while, someone would disappear. You'd hear about somebody going to AA and you'd never see him again. You know, kind of worried you a little. But I didn't have any real experience with AA prior to going in. But when I finally started to go, I mean, I really had a desire to separate from alcohol. And, you know, I heard for a number of years in AA, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I took that as the only requirement to stay sober is an honest desire to stop drinking. So I thought I just honestly needed to desire to not drink and things would be fine. I really had that idea. It didn't really help. The meetings that I was going to back at that time didn't really help me to change that erroneous belief. I mean, a lot of people back then kind of thought the same thing. I was going to meetings where it certainly wasn't literature-based recovery meetings. Yeah, we would have step meetings, but, you know, we'd just kind of talk about them or philosophize about them or give our opinion on them. We didn't go home and do them, you know. And that's just kind of the way it was. Now, I want to ask a redundant question here. Let's say you were a calculus major and you signed up for calculus and you started going to the calculus courses and you bought all the calculus books and you started going to the diner with the calculus people from the meetings and everything, but you didn't want to get involved in numbers. All right? That's what was really happening in my area of Alcoholics Anonymous. There were people that were going to meetings. They had the book. They were going out to the diner. They were talking about recovery, but they didn't want to get involved in any of the steps, or they didn't know, or there wasn't sufficient motivation or enthusiasm. Now, this really was what it was like in my area. You know, there's better areas, I think, in the United States than others. There's certainly pockets of enthusiasm, especially these days. You know, more and more there are areas where you really are hearing a very, very strong message. But back during this period of time, I was clueless. I really was clueless. The closest I got to being exposed to any of this stuff is, you know, they read How It Works. You hear How It Works almost in every single meeting, and it gets to the point where it's actually redundant. It's the thing that has to get read while you go get your coffee or, you know, finish up the conversation you're having with the person you're sitting next to. It's not something to really consider, to really contemplate. And that's kind of what it was like for me. Now, in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, around page 24-25, it talks about the hopeless alcoholic. And that paints a beautiful picture of me. I always wanted to be special. I always wanted, you know, I didn't want to be like a run-of-the-mill anything, let alone an alcoholic. But if you look at that, it's a beautiful description of the dilemma that I was faced with. I was a real alcoholic. And there's a lot of information in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that is not good news for the real alcoholic. There's things in the doctor's opinion. There's things in the first handful of chapters in the book that paint a really grim picture of the alcoholic. But, you know, I wasn't getting that in the meetings I was going to. I was not being told I was hopeless. I was being encouraged to not drink and come back tomorrow. They pat you on the head and they say, just don't drink today. You know, we'll see you back here tomorrow. Kind of like a football huddle or something, you know. You know, all right, we're going to keep it simple. You know, we're not going to, We're not going to drink. The first drink gets you drunk. Okay, break. You know, see you back here tomorrow. And, you know, that's kind of what it was like. You know, say the Lord's Prayer and off you go and we'll see you back here tomorrow. Now, that's all that stuff is okay. I'm really not criticizing it all unless you're in trouble, unless you're in real trouble with drugs and alcohol. Any relapsers in here? You know, the rest of you liars, you know, probably, you know, not putting your hand up. There's probably 70 or 80% of the people in this room are relapsers, okay? Now, did we really want to pick back up? I mean, really? Did we really want, I think I'll go throw my life down the toilet again. I'll go get a bottle of vodka and crash another car, and get thrown back out, you know, and have no place to live. It sounds like good ideas. Nothing on TV tonight. I mean, we don't really make those decisions. And what I'm saying is I'm going to AA meetings. I'm going to outpatient meetings. I'm doing all of this stuff. I'm doing all this stuff. And it's just, I end up buying a, here's what happened. I'm almost got 90 days in AA. I'm just finishing up my outpatient, which I'm paying like $60 a night to go to this outpatient. And anybody in here familiar with group where they sit in a circle and, you know, everybody like talks about their stuff. Like, all right, here's all my stuff. I want to tell you all about my stuff. Oh, it's terrible. Oh, it's, all these people is rough. And I would always sit there, hurry up. You know, shut up. I want to talk about my stuff. You're taking too much time, you know. I want to talk too. And you know, I'm doing that. And I'm going to AA meetings where I'm like rendered mute because I have all that self-centered fear, you know, that everybody's looking at me and I wonder what they're thinking about me. And I'm like all the self-centered repression and everything. I'm going to AAs. I'm like slinking in and, you know, sitting down and listening to the meeting and, you know, just wanting to get the hell out of there. And as soon as the meeting's over, I get to holler. But I'm going, okay? What more do you people want? I'm going. I'm going to these meetings. I'm paying for this outpatient. I'm telling my bosses and everything that I'm never drinking again. I'm going to go. I'm with the A&As now, you know, and you don't have to worry about me crashing any more trucks or blowing it. I was an electrician or blowing anything else up, you know. Everything's going to be fine now, you know. I promise not to quit in a blackout and then come in the next day not knowing I quit anymore, you know. I won't do that anymore. And so I'm telling all these people, you know, I'm telling my family that everything's going to be fine. I'm going to be wonderful now. You know, you got no idea how wonderful I'm going to be as long as there's no, you know, I'm not drinking. And I mean, I had made a commitment to this Alcoholics Anonymous thing. And I'm on the way to an AA meeting. And here's the thought that comes into my head. I haven't really been, really doing this Alcoholics Anonymous thing. I still hadn't gotten a sponsor yet because I hadn't found the right guy. And, you know, I still hadn't joined a home group yet because the groups I were going to were like autonomous meetings. They weren't home groups meetings. You know, so I hadn't done some of the things that they kind of recommended in AA. So, and also, you know, it had been a while since I'd been drunk. It had been about, I don't know, almost 90 days since I'd been drunk. So I didn't really remember what it was like to put alcohol in my body. You know, at least I was convincing myself that. So I thought, you know, if I buy a gallon of vodka and I drink it, I'll feel so bad that, first, number one, I'll remember what it's like to be drunk and I'll remember that I don't want to do it. And number two, it'll motivate me into doing this AA stuff better because I'll feel so bad. So sounds like a plan, you know. I mean, this is why I think we get sponsors. You know, I mean, imagine running that by a sponsor. Yeah. Hey, Pete, I'm going to buy a gallon of vodka today to help my recovery. What do you think? You know, I mean, listen to this plan. I mean, anybody in here sponsor, you know, and you get the newcomer plans every once in a while, you're like horrified. Like, oh my God, you're going to do what? I don't think so. Anyway, I did. I bought the gallon of vodka. I took it home and I started drinking it and everything's fine until I get to like drink number three. And all of a sudden it dawns on me the colossal, enormous mistake I've just made. You know, because I've just opened up the cage door to the beast, and he's going to drag me around by the neck for as long as he wants to. I mean, once I put alcohol in my body, I'm in it. You know, I'm committed with the alcohol, and who knows what's going to happen. I mean, one time I came to in a dinghy on Tampa Bay. I'd passed out at a party. They put me in a dinghy and they cast me to sea. You know, I had no oars or anything. I'm like miles from shore in a dinghy. I got to tell you, being towed in by the Coast Guard was pretty embarrassing. You know, where's your dock? I don't know. I mean, crazy things like this were always happening. And, you know, alcohol was never, it was the greatest unrequited love affair of my life. You know, I just loved alcohol. I remember I would buy a good bottle of scotch or a good bottle of whiskey, and I'd just like look at it, just look at the label and talk to it. You know, you ever talk to your bottle? That's an important warning sign, by the way. You know? Start having a relationship with the bottle. You know, people walking by outside the room start to worry too. But anyway, I mean, I really needed to separate from alcohol, and I was really making an effort. I mean, I'm going to AA, and you know, all of a sudden now I'm drunk, and nothing was working. I really thought that this is it. I'm not going to be able to get away from this stuff. Now, what happened was I finally did end up sobering up. It was Christmas of 1989, and it was a bad scene at the homestead. You know, my mother was there, sisters, brothers, nieces, and nephews, and I just, you know, I was in an insane, raging blackout, and it really ended up being bad. And that's when I kind of came to, detoxed on the floor, and got to an AA meeting. Now, again, I'm thinking, I don't know if this is cool. I really didn't know whether Alcoholics Anonymous would work or not, because I really thought that I had tried it. You know, I mean, there's really two really big problems in Alcoholics Anonymous today that if they were solved, we'd probably be back around 75 to 93% recovery rates, the recovery rates that they used to get back in the day. One of them is strong sponsorship. You know, not the type of sponsorship where they just pat you on the head and they say, it'll, you know, keep it simple. It'll be okay. You don't worry about a thing, you know. But real sponsorship, the type of sponsorship where they get you involved with the recovery process and they hold you accountable, get you involved in service and all that other stuff. The other problem in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, today is that at least in some areas, the emphasis has been taken off of the step process, the recovery process, and put on the fellowship process, put on the sober baseball teams and, you know, all this other stuff that might be a little bit more fun than actually going through the steps. And again, there's really nothing wrong with sober softball or anything like that, as long as it's as well as a recovery process and not instead of. Now, again, I speak from my own personal experience about this, because until I started to experience myself a recovery process, I was just, I was, you know, rolling the dice every single day on whether I was going to drink or not. You know, when they talk about powerlessness in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, that's really what they mean. They mean powerless. Powerless is powerless. Our egos, the alcoholic ego, wants to balk at a concept like that. The ego doesn't want to admit to the fact that there's nothing we can do to prevent our next relapse. That's not something that we want to admit. It's not something that you hear very much in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, but it's at core the beginning of the recovery process, to admit defeat, to fully concede to my innermost self that I'm alcoholic and all that means. And again, I just didn't know what the hell was going on in the early days. There's a lot of pain and a lot of suffering that we all go through. It's amazing the amount of pain, the alcoholics, and despair and pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization that we can that we can experience and still keep going on. In my particular case, I had I'd lost a lot of jobs. I'd had about 13 jobs in 10 years. My family had left. You know, I cared for them very much. It wasn't something that I wanted to see happen. But my wife and my daughter, they packed up and they moved away with the car and the dog. I'd lost almost all of my friends. To drink alcoholically and to really make a commitment to drink alcoholically, you can't allow a lot of things to be in your way. And it's not like you make a decision every day, well, I am going to drink a glass of bourbon today and it's going to cost me my family. And tomorrow I'm going to drink a glass of bourbon and it's going to cost me my job. And the next day I'm going to drink a glass of bourbon and it's going to cost me my friends. It's not as clear as that. The path down into active alcoholism is slower than that most of the times. And it's not something that we can really compute. We can't really, our perception is skewed. We have a lack, an inability to really perceive the truth as it is. We don't know the truth from the false a lot of times. Strong AA, Strong Alcoholics Anonymous, Strong NA, or whatever fellowship you're in, can help save a lot of lives. There's a lot of people that come into our fellowships and just don't connect for one reason or another. Sometimes it's not our fault. We've carried a strong message to them. We've done really good 12-step work. But again, there's going to be times where they just didn't hear it. They came in, they sat in the meeting, they heard a lot of people talking about the problems they had when they were drinking or the resentment they have with their neighbor or, you know, the fan belt went bad on the Mercedes again or, you know, the tennis pro was rude this morning to me and I just don't know what to do. I mean, you hear a lot of stuff like this in the meetings and, you know, I think it's important to work with these newer people at an identification process. It's the one thing that works so well in Alcoholics Anonymous, one drunk talking to another. I don't know about any of you, but a lot of people tried to talk to me about my drinking for many, many years because it was aberrant. My drinking was just bizarre. I mean, I would get a new job and they'd say, "Hey, Chris, you want to go for a drink after work with us? We're going out to the bar." I'd say, "Sure." The next morning, I'd come in not remembering what happened, and they'd be like, "Just from now on, stay away from me. I never, ever want to drink with you again. You know, you tried to get us into a fight with, you know, those bikers. You know, I mean, I did what? You know, I wouldn't remember any of this stuff. It was terrible." So you know, this drinking and the things that happen to us are absolutely horrible. So when somebody comes into Alcoholics Anonymous, the identification process is so important. Without the identification, I don't know if I would have been able to get started with this. The first person I think that I identified with and who really knew from experience what I was going through was a counselor at my first rehab. A pity he didn't counsel me. I only met him one time when he signed me into the rehab, and I, you know, the whole 28 days, I didn't have one appointment with the guy. But anyway, be that as it may, when I was sitting down there, and he was asking me the questions, "How much do you drink? What do you do?" I mean, I could tell. This guy was looking into me, and I could tell he knew from experience what was going on, and I couldn't lie to this guy. I'd been lying my whole life about how much do you drink? I had two. You know, how many times have we had two? Oh, man. I think the last time I said I had two, I'm driving home from a friend's house, and I should not have been driving. I was going to stay over, but something happened. I had gotten an argument with somebody. I had to get out of my car. I couldn't stay there. I drive home. I'm about three blocks away from my house, and the cops pull me over. And he comes to the window. I roll the window down, and you know how we're indignant. You know, what are you pulling me over for? So he goes, license, registration, insurance card. So I lean over, I open up the glove compartment, and I'm fumbling in there. I mean, I'm drunk. I mean, I'm fumbling in there. Finally, I just kind of give up, and I scoop up everything in the glove compartment and hand it to him. You know, maps and, you know, pencils and combs and, you know, everything that was in there. And you know, he wasn't real happy about having to sort through that stuff. So he goes, you get out, you know, come on, step outside. You look like you're under the influence of alcohol. I'm going to give you a sobriety test. I can't really remember how that went. But so he arrests me, takes me back to the police station. So I'm in the police station. And, you know, I've like a hazy recollection of this. I wasn't quite in a blackout, but I was pretty close, okay? And they videotaped me. And, I remember, anybody in here ever see their videotape from a DWI? Whatever you do, don't, okay? You know what I mean? It's really, really bad. You'll need therapy and everything else after it. But anyway, he films me, and I remember getting the ABCs right. You know, damn it, I got the ABCs right. So you know, they arrest me, they give me the tickets, I go home. I hire this lawyer. And I said, you know, $1,500 I paid this lawyer. This is like 1983. I said, okay, we're going to go in and we're going to fight this because I did well on the sobriety test. Okay, this is what I thought. Now, we go into the police station. I've got this high-priced attorney with me. And they're going to put us in a room to watch the videotape. And the cop who hands it to my lawyer is chuckling while he hands it to him. He's going, you know, there you go. And I'm a little worried. He puts the thing in and he turns on the TV, and I'm horrified. Okay, I'm horrified. Now, there's things on there like they're videoing me walking the line. You don't have to walk the straight line, and my hands are on the wall. And I say, oh, excuse me, you can't use your hands to walk the straight line. And then they get to the ABCs, which I aced, by the way, okay? And here's how I did the ABCs. A, B, it was hard. And in between D and E, I asked for a cigarette, you know? I mean, it was just, I'm like, and my lawyer, $1,500, he's sitting there, okay? He's real serious, $1,500 serious. Finally, at the end, they turn to me and they say, we're going to turn the video camera off in a minute. Do you have anything else you'd like to add, you know, while we're doing this? And I look at the video camera and I go, like this, right? And I'm so drunk. My tongue is like slapping back and forth. I'm so drunk. And I'm like, and my lawyer, who's been really cool, this whole thing goes, and he just starts. He's like, you can hear the cops down the hall laughing, you know. Oh, and I'm like, okay, I guess we'll plead, you know. $1,500. I could have said guilty myself, you know. That was bad. But, I mean, these were things that were happening to me just time and time again. You know, the funny thing is we're smart people, right? But do we do stupid things? Have you done some stupid things out there? Oh, man. And, you know, I truly think we're good people that do bad things, too. I've never met a real alcoholic, somebody who I've gone through the first step with and know myself as well as they know that they're an alcoholic who's evil. I haven't seen it. I've seen evil people in AA, you know, they wander in, you know, with one objective or, you know, other motivations besides recovery, and you will find them in AA. But I've never found, like, the real alcoholic, the person that this fellowship was designed for. But so to get back to my point here, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I'm struggling. I mean, I've got a lot of that repressed self-centered fear. I've got a lot of resentment. You know, I'm just resentful at everybody and everything. I mean, I can't stand in line at a grocery store. I mean, I can't, because I want to kill whoever's in front of me with, like, coupons and, you know, the price cards and the credit cards and sit there and talk, you know, while they're, you know. I mean, I want to, don't you know, I'm in a hurry, get out of my way. I mean, I had all this like repressed resentment, and I had this guilt and remorse and shame from the things I had done. I mean, I had done some really bad things. I'll cover one of them right here. My daughter I loved more than anything in the world. She was the one innocent thing in my life. She was like about 7 or so when 7 or 8 when I sobered up, but she'd be visiting me, and I'd say things to her like, you know, Danielle, tomorrow's Saturday and Daddy's gonna take you to the Bronx Zoo. We're gonna go to the zoo. We're gonna see all the animals. We're gonna see the elephants and the camels. Oh, Daddy, we're gonna go to the zoo. We're gonna go to the zoo, right? So I would, but what would happen? I'd get really drunk Friday night, and I'd wake up in the morning half dead. And because Friday night drinking was just a little bit heavier than Thursday night, you know, and I would feel sick. And so when you feel sick, what do? You need a little hair of the dog. You need to start drinking again. So I'd start drinking again. My daughter would come in and be like, 9 o'clock, Daddy, when do we go? This is where we go. Oh, well, Danielle, you know, Daddy's sick today. You know, we're not going to be able to go to the zoo today. You know, maybe tomorrow we'll go to the. And I would break her heart. Time after time after time. Now, did I want to do that? I don't think so. You know, I don't think so. Did I want my family to have to like move 5 states away to be safe because I was a violent blackout drinker? No, I wouldn't want that. I mean, I burnt my mother's house down twice, you know, drinking and leaving cigarettes out. I mean, you think that's something I wanted to do? I mean, my life was really, really difficult to live at this point in time. And I'm going to AA meetings, but I'm still feeling a lot of this emotional pain. I'm still feeling the they call it the bondage of self in our literature, the bondage of self. It's a beautiful way to describe it when the self manifests itself in all these different ways. You know, so many of the spiritual programs and religious traditions and spiritual traditions are about minimizing the self, trying to counteract the negative manifestations of the self. Well, there's nobody who's running on more self than the alcoholic. And I'll tell you what, it makes life very, very painful. And here I am. I can't even drink anymore, you know, because I'm on the wagon or whatever in early AA, and I'm going to these AA meetings. And the second time I'm in, I figure I'm just going to go crazy. I was going to like 4 meetings, but I'm going to like 12 meetings a week now. Okay, I'm going to like 12 meetings a week. I'm taking people out to the diner to eat afterward. I'm hanging out. I decide I'm going to be a secretary at this meeting. You know, I'm a treasurer over here. I'm starting to, you know, I'm even sponsoring. This is about a year, a little bit less than a year into my sobriety. I'm already sponsoring, which is like, I was talking to the first guy I ever sponsored the other day. I go, do you know how lucky you are to be alive? You know what I mean? With me as a sponsor, I mean, I had my head up my ass, you know, for like the first couple of years. But, you know, he was able, he's sober about 17 years now. Anyway, I'm going to all these meetings, but I got to tell you, a pin could drop and I could drink. I mean, there was a great speaker from California who used to say, we're all here by seconds and inches, you know, but the grace of God, by good luck. I mean, who knows all the things that have to fall into place for us actually to be sitting in these chairs tonight, sane of mind, hopefully, and sober. It's, you know, the chances are against us, and the chances were against me. And I'm going to a lot of meetings, and I'm really, really trying to. I'd gotten a sponsor this time. And he was what I describe as an oral tradition sponsor. What I mean by that, and certainly with no disrespect, they basically pass on wisdom teachings. Okay, a lot of them are great. You know, a lot of them are the first drink gets you drunk. You know, don't drink the first drink. Okay, that would be fine if I could not have the first drink. So some of these wisdom traditions kind of fall short. I had a very, very one of the reasons I am sober is because of this sponsor. I do want to say that. He got me really active in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he pushed service work. He had me going to rehabs. He had me volunteering at these picnics and, you know, getting involved in AA, speaking and doing a lot of these things, which I think had a lot to do with my ability to stay sober. But I hadn't done anything with recovery. I hadn't really experienced recovery. And I'll tell you what, if you haven't experienced recovery, you don't know what it is. I mean, it's something that needs to be learned experientially. Again, you can read the book Alcoholics Anonymous. You can memorize the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and you cannot have an experience with it. I had yet to really have an experience with Alcoholics Anonymous, but I was having a fellowship experience, and it was sufficient, I believe, for me to stay sober for about a year and a half. Now, here's what happened with me, and I think we all have our own stories if we're lucky enough to have been placed in front of someone who's been able to take us through the steps. We've all got our own stories. But mine was this guy, Radio Shack Mike. He was a friend of mine, one of the guys that I got sober with. He was actually the first person to talk to me in AA. I mean, I was like, believe it or not, I was like scary. Like I was like, I looked like I was crazy. And there was very few people who would talk to me. But this guy, he was nuts too. So he came up one time and he said, "Hey, Chris, would you help me out with something? My roommate just beat up my other roommate, and I'm afraid to go home, and I want somebody to back me up." "I'm with you. Let's just stop at my house." And we stopped at my house, and I got a knife about this lawyer. I said, "Let's go." You know, I mean, I was crazy. And we were friends for life after that, you know what I mean? But Radio Shack Mike, as we started to get sober, he started to go to the New Age bookstores. You know, and he used to get some wacky stuff. I remember this one book he turned me onto. There was like a crystalline being named Orin who channeled the universe's wisdom to you. You know, like I'm already crazy. You know, this is too much. And he handed me some tapes this one time, and they were affirmation tapes. And what you would do is you would put these in, and they would kind of guide you through affirmations. And this one kind of told me, "Go to the mirror, Chris, and say 100 times that you're a wonderful guy." So I got to tell you, it was difficult for me. Okay, I mean, you know, I had the low self-esteem with the big ego, but you know, there's no way I'm convincing myself I'm a wonderful guy. All right, I'm a loser. You know, and so these tapes, I just got really resentful. You know, these tapes were just not making it for me. And on hindsight, I'm trying to treat my alcoholism with affirmations. And I might as well try to stop a tractor trailer with a cobweb. You know what I mean? But, you know, that's with hindsight. Everything we know these days is with hindsight. But anyway, he hands me some more tapes later on. He says, "Chris, you're hardcore. You'll like these." And it was 8 90-minute tapes, which right away was kind of daunting for me. You know, I mean, 8 90-minute tapes, it's a little bit much. But I had about a 40-minute ride to work and nothing better to do. So I started listening to them. And I'm sure probably at least half of the people in this room were exposed to Joe and Charlie tapes at one time in their life. I mean, that's a great introduction to the recovery process. It really is. And I started listening to this, but you know, I wasn't happy about what I was hearing. What I was I was very resentful because I was going to so many meetings. I was, you know, I was taking people out. I thought I was Mr. AA. I thought I was doing more than my sponsor wanted me to do. I was going to more meetings and I was hanging out with more people. I really thought that if you could grade an AA, you would have given me an A. You know, I really thought that. I was doing everything. And these sets of tapes basically said this: "Chris, if you haven't started working the spiritual exercises out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous with a sponsor and you're not actually taking these steps, you don't have a program. So don't tell people you're working your program because you don't have a program. And when you drink, you know, don't tell everybody that AA didn't work for you, because AA is a set of spiritual principles, spiritual in their nature. If when practice is a way of life, will expel the obsession to drink and enable the user to become happily and usefully whole." Okay? So that's really what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. There's another great quote from Bill Wilson saying, the sole purpose of an AA group is the teaching and practice of the 12 steps. You know, we've kind of lost that in our area with some of the closed-minded discussion meetings. You know, you're not really learning very much. But again, I started listening to these tapes, and I got all the way through them because I was curious. Now, the thing is what's great about identification with an alcoholic is the truth will haunt you. If you go on a 12-step call and somebody's drinking, you can hit them with the truth, and you can hit them with your own personal experience, and usually they're going to know you're telling the truth because you're going to say things to them that they've never said to anybody else. So they're going to be able to identify with you because you have the same affliction that they have. Well, that was happening in these tapes. But basically, they were talking about the recovery process. The recovery process in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I resented it because, number one, it meant work that I hadn't done. What do you mean? There's work to do. Number two, I really thought I was doing a good job, and this was kind of a slight to my sobriety. But a few things happened. I put the tapes to the side. But the truth haunts, you know, the truth will haunt you. And what happened was there were some things that happened in my life. I got involved with somebody and, you know, Mrs. Wright. I mean, you know how that is. my sponsor, when I told my sponsor about it, I thought he'd be happy for me. You know, I have like 14 months. Phil, guess what? I'm seeing this girl. You should have seen the look on his face. He was like, oh, you know, he's thinking, there's going to be an uninterrupted series of phone calls. You know, as soon as this goes bad, there's going to be an uninterrupted series of phone calls I'm going to have to take for 6 months. You know, that's what he's, so he's like, oh. And he pulled me aside, and this is what he said. He goes, Chris, let's say there's a gymnasium filled with women, and somewhere in that gymnasium is an axe murderess. What the cops would do is they would let you loose in there, and wait till you become attracted to somebody. And then they'd throw the cuffs on her. Okay? And I'm like, oh, Phil, you don't understand. We're in love. He was horrified. And then he said, Chris, the chances of you two getting married and living a happily married life are 1 in 100,000 maybe? He didn't understand me, I guess, you know. He didn't he had this crazy habit of being right, you know. I hated that about him. I don't think he was ever wrong. Anyway, so when this thing went down like the Hindenburg, I had nothing. I had no booze. My spiritual condition was in the toilet because all I was doing was fellowship. And you know, I remember grabbing these tapes because out of desperation, I grabbed these tapes. And, you know, today I don't think it's a bad idea for people to get involved, you know, in their first couple of years of recovery. And what happened to me was it sent me flying into the steps. You know what I mean? And if you're stupid enough to break two people apart, they'll just go mess up two other people, you know? So sometimes it's better to just leave well enough alone. But what, you know, what happened was, I mean, I was in horrible emotional pain, just crippling, horrible emotional pain. And I grabbed these steps and I started listening to the steps and I put a notebook off to the side and I opened up the big book. And in a very, very, you know, imperfect way, I started to go through the steps. And, you know, when Joe and Charlie said, we stop here and we list the people, places, and institutions and principles that we're resentful at. We actually list them in black and white. That's what I actually did. And it was kind of, I'm going to, you know, we're going to talk more this weekend about this process. But I will tell you this. As I started to move through this process, I started to change. My perspective started to change. I wasn't as resentful anymore. I didn't have as much self-centered fear. I wasn't, I didn't have as much guilt or remorse or shame, especially after I started started to do some amends. And I started to heal spiritually. And I so believe that alcoholism is a spiritual illness. I so believe that. I believe alcohol is a symptom. It's a big one, but it's a symptom of the spiritual illness. I believe I responded to alcohol a little bit more than the earth people around me because it did something for me that it doesn't do to normal people. It shifted my perception. It got rid of the self-centered fear. It got rid of my anxiety and my tension and my guilt and remorse. And it actually wiped my emotional slate clean, the alcohol. So I believe that at the very, very beginning of the illness is the spiritual part of the illness. So, you know, where Bill Wilson and where the, you know, people back in the Oxford group, they had the answer. They had the answer, which was a spiritual transformation. Transformation spiritually, and the other recoveries can follow. And this is basically what the book Alcoholics Anonymous is laying out for us. It's laying out for us, it's spiritual recovery 101. It's spiritual living 101 is what it is. How they all figured this out. We have Mitchell here today, who's a very, very adept and a scholar on the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and a lot of the things that went on back in the early days that wrapped around all the circumstances that kind of manifested for Alcoholics Anonymous to happen the way it did. There's some studying I've done too over the years with these people. And the more I learn about the founders and the first 100 and stuff, the more I'm convinced that they were battier than bedbugs, these people. You know what I mean? They really were. They were some bizarre people. And for all of those processes to fall into place and for them to put the architecture together for a spiritual form of recovery from alcoholism is what really still boggles my mind. I'm still really impressed with how all that happened, because it just doesn't seem to me that any of them were that smart back then, you know, to come up with such a brilliant, brilliant series of steps and the recovery process that was put together in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, without exaggeration, because I've done a lot of workshops, I've done a lot of working with others, a lot of one-on-one at my house, a lot of studying on my own, I've probably been through the big book 200 times. It's without exaggeration, in a very studied way. And I'll still come across something that'll look brand new to me. You know, whoa, what is that all about? Wow, look at that. You know, and it'll be like I'm coming to it brand new. That's really the sign of a mature and classic religious or spiritual text, for it to have that much depth. And for there to be, you know, so many, it'll hit you kind of where you are, wherever you are spiritually, it'll have something to say to you at that time. You know, it's just an absolutely marvelous, marvelous book with exactly what we need to know and especially what we need to do laid out pretty clearly. And again, I think there's a renaissance. I think there's a resurgence of groups and especially people who want us to get back to the basics, want us to get back to the recovery principles in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't think there's a more important thing for Alcoholics Anonymous as a purpose. You know, remember what Bill Wilson said, the sole purpose of an AA group is the teaching and practice of the 12 steps. So really that's a good direction for me, and it's a good direction for a group. It's a good direction for a group. The teaching and practice of the 12 steps. For me to be able to teach it, I have to practice it. I just do. I think hypocrisy is something that we pick up on right away. If somebody's full of it, an alcoholic will pick up on it right away. We're very, very acute at seeing other people's character defects. It's just, you know, we've got blinders on for our own. You know, I was doing the last four step I was helping somebody with. Huge amounts of resentments, giant second columns, big, detailed, monstrous third columns. Nothing in the fourth column, you know? Nothing. I'm like, oh, wait a minute here. You know, this doesn't make any sense. You played no part in this at all. Nothing. Nope. You know? And so I go, this is how I do, you know, I'm kind of guided when I'm working with people. I intuitively know how to handle those things, you know, that probably would have baffled me at one point in time or the other. And I truly think in my 12-step work, that's probably where the guidance of God shines through most with me. But what I said was, I said, give it to me, I'm taking it home. And I took it home and I wrote out his fourth column, okay? And I said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to consider some of the things that I put in the fourth column, and I want you to see kind of where I'm going with this and add to it. You know, when you hand me back this defective, you know, treatise on how you've been wronged your whole life, I want to see some truth in the fourth column. You know, sometimes we just can't see the truth. Again, to get back to a point I was making earlier, what can we do better in Alcoholics Anonymous today? What can we do better? We can be better at carrying the message. I truly believe that. Instead of patting somebody on the head and encouraging them not to drink and come back to a meeting, how about getting them over to your house and opening up the book Alcoholics Anonymous together and get started on sharing an experience of recovery with each other? Yeah, it takes more time. I know we're busy people, but from my personal experience, all of the good things in my life today are a direct result of practicing the recovery process and sharing that recovery process with other people. So when you're asked to sponsor or when you're asked to help somebody, take that seriously. Take that responsibility seriously. And again, try not to sidestep it and take the easy way out. Sometimes it's difficult. I know that there are some good shows on today. When I got sober, I got to tell you, when I got sober, Slipovision was bad. You know, it was just, there was some terrible shows on it. BJ and the Bear. I mean, you know, bunch of crap. Today, man, there's like 500 cable channels, you know, and I've got some shows that I absolutely love. So what I do is instead of sit home and watch them, I'll either buy them on DVD or record them or have somebody record them. And then maybe on the weekend or you know, Mary Beth and I have date nights that are pretty sacred to us. We have at least two date nights a week that we unless we got something else to do. they're sacred, you know. And unless there's a speaking commitment or something, right? But anyway, you know, then we'll catch up on the TV we've missed, but. But I mean, we really are responsible for people's lives out there. There's people dying every day from drug addiction, alcoholism, that we could be sharing a recovery experience with. Let's just try to take that seriously, really. We don't take ourselves seriously, but let's take that seriously, please. Because, you know, I've been to too many funerals and, I don't think every one of them was necessary. I really don't. That's all I have tonight. I think I will bring up, what's that? Take a look. We're going to take a 5-minute break. Okay. That's what we're going to do. Thank you.